to Vision Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Thanks for joining us. It is 8 o'clock in the morning here, July 25th, 2017. I'm on the West Coast. We really appreciate you tuning in. I'm very excited about our guest, Mr. Chuck Johnson from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. We attempted to do this a few weeks ago, if you remember the show where it was totally dead air for half an hour. That was there was no one to help Jules out while she was still recuperating. So we've rescheduled, and this morning we have Chuck on the air with us. Thanks, Chuck, for joining us. We really appreciate it.
That's great to be here, as always.
Yeah, it's really awesome. So do you have anything in particular that's on your mind or that Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility is working on currently that you want people to know about?
Well, one of the things that's been on our mind a lot since it became a more realistic concern is this NuScale Corporation in Corvallis, Oregon, which is designing a new nuclear power system consisting of up to 12 50-megawatt nuclear power plants in a common pool of water for cooling for both normal cooling and for as part of its emergency cooling system. This design has been going on. It's a spinoff from Oregon State University, been going on since the early 2000s, and was bought by Fluor Corporation, a big engineering company from Texas, and has the backing of the U.S. government through grants that Congress and the president established to encourage new nuclear design. So they're in the design phase with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission right now, and they are the one, at this point, shining hope of the nuclear power industry to design and build a new system that actually works and that they can mass produce and sell all over the world. And we have a lot of concerns about it, just as we would about any new nuclear power system. But this one's in our backyard, and we feel a lot of personal responsibility to question whether this is a good idea and stop it from happening in Oregon and Washington, and help our friends in Idaho and Utah prevent the proposed first one that they want to build out at near Idaho Falls, tentatively scheduled at this point for completion in 2026. They were saying 2023 last year, so it's already slipped 3 years.
Wow. So you're talking about the small nuclear reactors, right? This SMRs?
Yep. They call them small modular reactors. The whole idea of modular construction is something that the nuclear power industry has been trying to use as a way to bring down the cost. And they used modular construction with the Westinghouse AP1000 reactors they've been trying to build in Georgia and South Carolina and in other places around the world. And it has not worked. You know, it's a surprise, surprise. You create modules or portions of these reactors in a factory and ship them to the site to reassemble. And, oh, they don't fit together exactly correctly. There were problems with the manufacturing. You know, I mean, this is totally predictable. Who hasn't heard about recalls with automobiles and other complicated things that are built in factories? This is a complicated technical machine that needs to work perfectly, and you're going to try to mass produce it. Well, you know, you better have really competent people working in your factory, or there are going to be problems when you try to reassemble them. But, you know, the hope springs eternal on this one. And the idea is you'd create the entire reactor. These are mini reactors, or, you know, by nuclear power standards, they're small reactors, 50 megawatts each.
How big would that look like? Like, if we were to look at it, Chuck, what would it be, the size of a big building? Because the nuclear reactors now are gigantic, right?
Well, the reactors are big. The buildings around them are a lot bigger. These are long and thin fairly tall. But you could fit one with its shielding around it to protect it from bumps and so forth on the road. On the back of a semi truck is what they're claiming. You know, you basically a typical long haul semi truck with a contraption for holding this thing in place so that it didn't, you know, bounce around too much before you got it to your site. And that's how they're selling it, is these modules would be delivered by semis and then assembled with the construction of the plant itself would be the non-functioning parts would be done locally, and all of the parts that were involved in the reactor would be brought in from factories and assembled on site with as much of the manufacturing and the assembly done off-site, so that it's more a question of just connecting things together when you bring them to the site. That's the whole theory. And the idea is that if you build enough of these and mass produce them, then the price comes down and they start to become competitive. But boy, I remember a few years back, Westinghouse, before they had their financial implosion and declared bankruptcy this last year over the large reactors they're building in the South, was talking about small modular reactors, and their president was saying you'd have to have orders for about 40 or 50 of these reactors before you'd start to break even. And so far they only have the one order that isn't even completed yet. You know, it's not finalized yet with Utah Municipal Utilities.
And didn't you say it's already been pushed back 3 years?
Well, in terms of the completion date that they're projecting, I mean, that's all speculation anyway, because right now they have to get through the design proving phase with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They submitted their design in January this year, which was already a couple years later than they originally hoped. And they're expecting to be done by 2020 with getting design approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And that may happen. You know, I mean, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has generally been very favorable to the nuclear power industry. Almost, you know, generally that's
that makes me laugh.
Understatement. Yeah.
They've never sent a license application they didn't like. They even knew that Columbia Generating Station, I mean, that when they found out they lied, intentionally lied after the work your organization did about the earthquakes, there was no conversation about revoking their license. None.
No, they don't do that. They don't deny licenses and they don't revoke licenses. I mean, they just have never done it. Even with those reactors at San Onofre, that the steam generators that that had shaken themselves apart months after being, you know, these new and improved steam generators, tubes were cracking almost immediately after they were installed. Totally faulty system. And the NRC was afraid to make a decision that was anti-nuclear. So they just put it off until the utilities down there couldn't stand it anymore and decided to close the reactor on their own. Because they basically were sitting there making no decision for years. And that's kind of how the NRC makes decisions, you know, is that it does it in a vacuum. If it sees something that's really, really bad, it probably won't rule in our favor, but it just won't rule in favor of the nuclear power industry. It'll let them do their own dirty work. So
it astounds me, the complete denial of harm to our environment and to people. I've only been paying attention to this for 5 years now. And I think about men like you and women like other activists like Heidi Lambert and Helen Caldicott, who've been after this for so long. And it is astounding to me the complete level of denial still by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that this really is a serious problem. They act like it's just like it's something slight that we can just clean up, like it's no big deal. Just go get the mop and we'll wipe it up. It blows me away, you know?
Yeah. Well, they're funny because they do have some regulations that, you know, are good, and they do actually report on them. The thing is, they always find an excuse or a reason to ignore them ultimately, you know? So they're very good. The NRC is good at documenting some of the problems that reactors have. And then if they're serious enough to actually threaten closing the reactor, then they suddenly get, you know, amnesia and an unwillingness to.
No harm to human health, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's at the end of every single statement. No harm to human health. Every report.
Right.
No immediate harm. They always say that. No immediate harm. Because, you know, the thing is, they're not really lying when they say that. We know it's kicked down the road, you know, 30 years from now. So,
yeah, cancer is not an immediate harm because it's not an immediate disease. You don't, like, have one exposure to radioactivity and go, oh, I suddenly have a cancer, you know. No, so obviously, when you say that, you can eliminate cancer down the road as a harm. You know,
so I wanted to ask you, I didn't actually ask you about this. I didn't actually have time before we went on the air. So if you don't know the answer, I just wanted to ask you, the NRC on their nuclear alerts right now, there was an event posted on 525 and they put up an event notification yesterday that I didn't understand what it meant. It's called Invalid Specification Actuation. It's considered a non-emergency. So what happened was it was a post-maintenance test for replacement of the power pressure vessel, low water level 3 indicator. So, and it's supporting...
Which reactor are we talking about?
It says, which reactor? Low rack indicator, tripping the RPV level 2 instruments of an unplanned start of a high pressure core spray pump. And it's emergency diesel. The reactor pressure vessel flooded up during the fueling outage, and thus
again, what reactor are we talking about? Where is it?
Region. This says this is what it tells. This is the information. This is why I don't really go to this too often. It says reactor type 2 GE5 RX type 2 unit 2 at the Columbia Generating Station.
Unit 2 is the Columbia. Oh, this is the CGS. Well, Unit 2 is the Columbia Generating Station because that was, whoops, Unit 2. All right. So what happened?
So they
had seen this.
Yeah. This is during the event, a single train HPCS system initiated normally but did not inject into the reactor pressure vessel as expected due to flooded up conditions of the reactor pressure vessel for refueling outage activities. The emergency diesel generator started normally in response to the initiation signal of HPCS, which is the high pressure core spray pump. Both HPCS and the emergency diesel generator function successfully. So what does this mean? Because it said it did not inject into the RPV, which is what, the reactor pressure vessel, due to RPV level being above level 8, which is an interlock to close HPCS RPV injection valve. When I read that, that kind of freaked me out. Does that mean anything? Like, I don't understand any of that.
Yeah.
Did you?
I don't understand it entirely. I'm going to have to look into it, but it's an additional problem they had. It sounds like with the restart, it's one they didn't report at the time. This was something that got posted when? I'm going to go look it up.
Well, it was reposted yesterday, 7/24. I kind of look at these. I just type in NRC. I just type in nuclear alerts, and it'll take me to the NRC nuclear alert page. And I kind of just check in to see.
No, I know that. But I mean, did it just show up?
7/24 was the last notification. The first, the actual event started 5/25.
Right. Because it was, the actual event started at 5/25.
Yeah, well, on May 25th. And then they're just now.
That was midway through the outage. So that's something they didn't report. They had some problems at the end of the outage that they reported because they were having trouble powering up. And they had to. I mean, it was obvious because they had started powering up and then they kind of lulled out for a couple of days, a really low level. And then they had to explain what that was about. But this is something that happened during the outage. That I had not heard about, so I'll have to look into it. We'll have to be on a different show, but there are more complications at CGS. They were hoping that this outage was going to be the one in which they proved themselves to the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations, which is this independent agency that the nuclear power industry set up after Three Mile Island to monitor themselves. And they're actually a little bit more strict than the NRC in terms of operation because they compare reactors against themselves. The NRC does not against the rest of the nuclear power fleet in the United States. And they grade everybody on a curve. So, you know, the NRC just has certain red lines you aren't supposed to cross. And when you do, then you get downgraded a little bit. But they don't have like an overall rating of how's your reactor doing compared to the others. INPO provides that. And the Columbia Generating Station has been in the bottom quarter now for years, a couple of years now, because of a series of problems that they've had at the reactor. They've been an underperforming nuclear power plant compared to others around the country. And it was so embarrassing to them that they got INPO to, which is, again, this private agency, to say, well, we're not allowed anymore for proprietary reasons to publish our ratings. They were even requiring them that they not be board members. Because they're a public body. And if they do, then it becomes public information and it's proprietary information. So they're even... they're basically institutionalizing, hiding things from their own board about the performance, which is really crazy. We have decades of ratings that are charted in Robert McCullough's huge study on the economics of the Columbia Generating Station. You know, several decades in which they've been reporting their INPO ratings, and now all of a sudden, because this has become an issue, they are, and because they're doing poorly and it's in the press, they're supposedly being forced by INPO not to reveal their ratings. So anyway, needless to say, this is a situation they're uncomfortable with, and they were hoping that this outage would go smoothly and that as time goes on, the bad events would recede into the past and they would move up the ratings a bit, but it looks like they're still having a lot of problems there. I just heard about another one yesterday. talk about right now because we're still investigating it, but it's relatively a relatively serious one.
At CGS,
At CGS.
So the next time you're on, maybe you'll be able to share all the information you've found out on it.
Yep. So this is one that I didn't even know about. So thank you for telling me about that.
Maybe it's interconnected. It'd be interesting to see if this is interconnected, you know?
No, this is a totally different thing. This reactor has had a lot of scrams, which is when you have the reactor automatically shut down because of, you know, something going wrong, and for safety reasons, it shuts itself down. And every time that happens, it does some damage to the reactor. There's a sudden shutdown of something as hot as a nuclear power plant, and cooling it down suddenly really puts a lot of stress on all of the metals and components that are in the reactor. Plus, it had operated for, you know, over a decade longer than it probably should have with a faulty condenser, which was putting copper. It was made out of brass, and it was leaching copper into the cooling water inside the reactor, and which they then had to inject chemicals to keep it from bonding with the fuel and forcing and causing the fuel to fail and encrusting itself inside the reactor vessel.
Oh my God.
So they had a horrible copper contamination problem inside there. And then of course the condenser kept springing leaks too, which was exposing the workers to radiation as they went and sealed these leaks up. When they replaced that condenser, if we had been involved, I just so rue the fact that we were not involved in fighting this reactor earlier before Fukushima, because they got permission to replace that condenser, and it was extremely expensive. They had to shut down for half a year, and they spent, I think, about $300 or $400 million to do it, you know, in addition to the loss of power. And that would have been a perfect time to close that reactor permanently. But we didn't. We weren't
Chuck,
around.
Can I ask you a question about these costs? Like, this is just stunning to me, the big numbers. What is the big cost? Like, if this is a construction job, why does it take $300, $400 million? Like, where is the cost? It's obviously inflated from what it ought to be, but how do they get these huge, every nuclear facility is just billions of dollars, you know, when you add it all up. Why?
Because for one thing, there's a lot of labor costs because people can only get so much radiation exposure. Something like this replacement of the condenser involves having workers getting into places that are pretty hot, and they can exceed their exposure limits. So you have to have a lot of workers to do that. Uh-huh. You can't very well have someone exceed their exposure limits and then not pay them. So you gotta, you gotta pay a lot for labor when you do something like that.
Yeah.
Plus, you want to build things that actually work. You know, in a nuclear power plant, you don't want them to have failures. So there's a lot of checking and double checking and quality control that should go into them. Sometimes things are built poorly anyway, but it's just the engineering task of creating a nuclear reaction that is so intensely hot, hotter than anything else that has, you know, ever occurred on the planet, and creates these intensely deadly radioactive byproducts. Just the engineering task is enormous, and that's why the cost is so high. If you don't care whether people die or not, which, you know, I would argue maybe they don't care nearly enough, but if you really didn't care at all, sure, you could build them cheaper. You know, if you said exposures to radiation, who gives a damn? Take your badges off and let's just work 24/7, you know? You could do it cheaper, but the NRC you know, to their credit, they don't want it to completely be an agency that does nothing. You know, they don't allow, there are rules and regulations. It's cheaper to run a nuclear, to build and run a nuclear power plant in China right now. And there's a reason for that. Their environmental regulations are, you know, very thin to begin with and mostly ignored. So I shudder about the fact that China is the one country in the world that's really aggressively pursuing nuclear energy. They're pursuing wind and solar and everything else too, but with nuclear energy, they're in the process of building about 14 reactors right now. And at the rate they're moving, they will surpass the United States as the largest nuclear power nation in the world within the next decade. And probably they're an excellent candidate for the next accident because they don't have the quality assurance that other countries do. So that's what costs money, you know.
Yeah. Well, I read an article about three months ago that it was only one nuclear reactor, and I don't remember the details of where it was, but they had issues because their concrete didn't hold up to standard. Like just their basic concrete, they had some concrete that didn't stand up to the pressure of the design. So it was halfway built and then it just collapsed down. So the article was about how they had to bring in a better grade of concrete to actually clear the debris. It put it back, they said, 5 years just clearing the debris and finding better concrete and doing things, you know, starting over was like a huge step because of their quality assurance was quite low. So, I mean, that is kind of a frightening thing. Like you have to actually trust the manufacturers that they're going to build these things, even if the design is faulty, but just building it could be a dangerous factor.
Well, you know, I mean, the prime example currently is France, which was for years held up by the nuclear power industry as being the shining example of how to do nuclear right. And the big scandal there right now, in addition to all the cost overruns in their new build that are just, you know, that have bankrupted Areva, which was a spinoff, a private spinoff that's now being absorbed by the French state-owned Electricité de France. But their manufacturing facility for the steel that they used in the containment vessels and in other really crucial parts they have been making steel components that are not up to the standard that they thought they were. They're supposed to be able to, you know, unfailingly resist the pressures inside of a reactor, and they don't, you know, the steel didn't have the right combination of additional elements that they expect to have in it. And they tested it about a year and a half ago that this was announced that they had been testing these components and discovered that they were not built to standard. And they've already built containment for their reactor system in Finland. They built the one in France, and I'm not sure if that same faulty steel is what they were using for the two they're building in China, but it set everything back, and the industry's been fighting with the government over whether or not they would allow them to just go ahead and use these faulty steel parts temporarily with the idea that they would then replace them with new components in a few years after they've, rebuilt them and then put them on so that they can try to at least get these reactors running and start to generate some electricity and stop. But so at this point, that's still hanging in the balance. But this is the French nuclear power system that was supposed to be, the highest standard in the world and the most competent people, and their nuclear power new build is just falling flat on its face. The only reason it's not completely bankrupt like Westinghouse is because It's backed by the French taxpayer at this point. And, you know, you can always squeeze more money out of your, out of an entire nation than you could out of, corporate investors.
well, you don't really have a choice, do you? I mean, really, you don't. Yeah. The taxpayers have no choice. It's like us. We pay for this, yeah. Whether, and honestly, even, you know, I honestly haven't really had the diligence to really pursue this, getting on the eWeb board. And it's difficult. Like I have an eWeb representative that supposedly we voted for. That person has never returned my phone calls. They have the meetings at odd times so that if you're in business, you can't really just stop your day and go. They make it so deviously hard for people, for average citizens to get engaged, to really pay attention to this. I mean, it's a devious way to go because they know that there's not much we can do about it. Like Columbia Generating Station, it needs to be shut down. I mean, I know you guys are working diligently to try to close this thing down. Robert McCullough put up a 24 to maybe 30 page article that I read about a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months now, about the excessive cost of this hideous monster. And that didn't even bat an eyelash. 2 days later, I read an article on some online article, you know, demeaning him, saying that he had overstated the costs and blah, blah, blah. It was like pushback from the nuclear industry. And it was like, next, move on.
Well, the thing is, it's a weird situation in terms of costs for us here in the Northwest, because there's a what they call a net billing contract between Energy Northwest, which is this consortium of electric publicly owned electric utilities in Washington state, and the Bonneville Power Administration. And so you can see what the costs are, and Rob has done that. He's isolated out the costs. They're not actually challenging him on that, because they can't, you know, it's their own figures. But what they're challenging is the replacement power, and they're claiming that, oh, you know, he's overstating what could be bought on the market, or he's understating the cost of if you replaced it only with renewable energy.
That's right.
Which is what this latest report is. You know, the latest report is about, because the first one he did several years ago said, hey, if we actually bought power on the market, we could be saving a couple $100 million annually as a region just by closing the Columbia Generating Station. And that would involve buying some power that would be generated from carbon sources of natural gas, because natural gas is cheap right now and looks like it will be for a while thanks to fracking. This is not great. But if you're just going strictly by market forces, which a lot of these conservatives normally would, except that it involves something they like, which is a nuclear power plant, then you would say, why are we doing this? So that argument didn't seem to hold enough water, and we have a lot of legitimate concerns among environmentalists about replacing one evil with another. You know,
well, so it goes back to what's really the real cost, right? When they say fracking's cheap, it's kind of like nuclear. The nuclear stuff is like, it's carbon free while it's running, but cradle to grave, it uses a lot of fossil fuel. Fracking causes a lot of environmental and human degradation. It really breaks down our living support system. So is that cheap?
Right.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, if you externalize the costs to the environment and to the rest of humanity and the planet, then sure, something can be cheap. You know, if you're causing excess methane gas to leak out into the environment and become an even more potent greenhouse gas in our atmosphere, that's an expense, but it's not one that gets billed to the drilling company. You know, and another expense is the contaminated water that the people living nearby have to either drink or avoid, you know. But that's, again, not something that the drilling company gets charged with under our current laws. But so anyway, we agreed that natural gas is, you know, not something we want. It's something we want to be phasing out, not encouraging. So So Robert's second study was purely on what it would take to replace it in a carbon-free way. And he found that it could be done, and it could be done economically. And that they were challenging that. And they're on a little close, they're on better ground on that, because even though the price of solar and wind has come down a lot, and even though we have hydro in this region, and we already have existing natural gas plants that we're using in this region that could be used to balance the load of the renewables, it's a little closer call in terms of cost. But it's comparable, and it's only the trend line, it looks like it only gets better. The cost of the reactor is going to become more and more expensive as the plant ages, and the costs of solar and wind continue to drop. And our ability to store using batteries or pumped storage are looking more attractive as time goes on as well. So you know, eliminating the need for even our existing natural gas plants over time. So I think, you know, the trend lines are heading our way. We just have to hope we don't have an accident at that stupid reactor before the natural trends help us win.
Or Diablo Canyon. I mean, we have quite a few, like, sort of really frightening places that are like potential serious disasters between Indian Point, Columbia Generating Station, Diablo Canyon. Mm-hmm. Those are all, to me, the hottest, the most dangerous facilities still operating because of their locations, you know, and the damage. Like, considering that CGS is right on the Cascadia, right in that Cascadia zone of the fault line, and there's a lot of rumblings going on. I mean, there's a lot of anxiety. I know, at least I've heard that here in Eugene. People are very conscious of the fact of the Cascadia fault line.
Well, okay, here's something that Bob Alvarez, who's a longtime nuclear critic, turned me on to that I somehow missed. Apparently, U.S. Secretary of Energy Rick Perry agrees with us on that. believe it or not, he was giving testimony in support of this new bill to encourage the revival of a Yucca Mountain nuclear waste site, and also an interim storage site for storing high-level radioactive waste. And part of his reasoning was that Energy Secretary Rick Perry warned that some U.S. facilities that store nuclear waste are at risk of suffering a catastrophic disaster. Let me read you the exact quote. This is from a CNBC link, and it has actually tape of him saying it. He says, let me find it here.
That'd be great to hear what he has to say.
Oh, boy. Anyway, he basically said that we could be facing anywhere along the Ring of Fire, includes the Pacific Coast, and actually includes Yucca Mountain, which he didn't think of that fact. But he said that, let's see, now here it is. Having those spent fuel rods and those cooling ponds in a region of the world that's inside that ring of fire, as they call it, and the potential to have a geologic event, we could have a repeat of what happened at Fukushima to some degree, Perry told members of the House Committee on Appropriations.
Wow.
Isn't that wild? That's just crazy. But thank you, Secretary Perry. You know, you're right.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that the way they hear this information, I mean, it's almost like there's a predisposed bias towards the nuclear industry by every single person in Congress. Like, they don't ever come out against it. They're automatically predisposed to building new reactors, improving nuclear power. But there is never any real hard conversation about, especially since WIP, what are we going to do with the waste? Because right now, since WIP fell apart, you know, all this waste is sitting there. Although Donna Gilmer corrected me and said that the waste to WIP does not come from the nuclear reactors, but You know, it's,
that's right.
We have all this waste just sort of sitting around at all, especially east of the Mississippi, where there's, you know, several, like most of our nuclear reactors are east of the Mississippi, and they're all just stacking up their waste year after year with nowhere to go. And it's not an emergency. That's what really blows me away is it's, to me, that's a catastrophic emergency.
Well, that's it. There's a guy named Mark Rabinowitz who lives in your town. I don't know if you've come across.
I do know Mark.
He makes a statement that he quotes someone. I forget exactly who, but this is more his statement in my mind now, the worst nuclear reactor is not one that fails somewhere along the line, but it's one that functions perfectly through its entire lifespan and generates a complete complement of the high-level radioactive waste that will then take 10,000 to 100,000 years to decay to a safe level. So basically, the point is, these are the Columbia Generating Station is really ought to be renamed the Columbia High-Level Radioactive Waste Generating Station, because that's what all of them are. They generate mounds and tons and, you know, enormous quantities of extremely deadly material, so deadly that if you stood next to it unshielded, you'd get a lethal dose in seconds. You know, Arjun Makajani makes the joke. He's a physicist who is a nuclear power opponent, that if Evel Knievel, was still alive, or his son, Robbie, I suppose, fired up his motorcycle and jumped across an open spent fuel pool with no water shielding it, he'd be dead by the time he got to the other side of the
pool.
Yeah, that's how much gamma radiation is being given off. It's enough. That's why the shielding is so critical. And then after 10 years, you could still get a lethal dose in about a minute and a half. So it stays really dangerous and hot. After 100 years, it might take you 12 minutes, you know, to get a lethal dose. But it's even 100 years later, it is still extremely dangerous material to be anywhere near. And that's why this entire industry is insane, you know? It's just absolutely insane.
Yeah, that's what I can't get
over. Creating something that difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
For any purpose.
I read an article, actually. I think it was the day that it didn't work for you to be on the air with us, and I picked up the radio show like 25 minutes into it or something. I just went to the internet and picked up a local story that was new that day. It was actually talking about that we have been building 60 the world has been building 60 nuclear facilities a year. 2017 is the first year where we're only going to be building 59. The whole report was about the decline of the nuclear industry and how the world has sort of lost its favor towards this because it's becoming evident that we have not figured out what to do with the waste, right? That's the big thing, is how can we build 60 nuclear facilities a year and then have all this waste melting up?
One thing about that number, though, is, Lonnie, is that it's always inflated, because they never, once somebody actually starts on a construction of a nuclear power plant, and if they don't officially say we're going to start up again on finishing construction, that plant is still considered under construction. So about, maybe 20 of those 50 are plants that are probably not going to get finished, but they still get carried on the books as being, built under construction. It's like their TVA has plants like that, Tennessee Valley Authority. And they're one of the few that actually went back and actually finished a couple of them, one in the 90s and one recently. They finished after having it sit for a while. But they still have other under construction reactors on their books. And there are ones all over the world that probably will never get built, but you know, the theoretically still under construction. The real active places right now, China is by far the most active in terms of building reactors. And then behind them were South Korea and, you know, just a smattering of different countries building just a few reactors at a time. South Korea's government put a halt to all of their new nuclear construction and announced that they're phasing out their reactors program in their own country. They're still trying to export. Apparently, the nuclear power industry was powerful enough to get them to give that concession. But they're such a densely populated small country, and they're sitting right next to North Korea, who doesn't really even need nuclear weapons if they can, you know, if they want to create radiological disaster, they just have to bomb their nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
So they're pre-positioned dirty bombs, basically.
Wow.
As they are throughout the world, you know, that's obviously one of the many problems with siting a nuclear power station is if you ever find yourself in a war, it might be tempting to your opponent to bomb your nuclear reactor.
We have lots of those. That's really, and that's kind of scary the way they're all, I mean, look at Sister Megan Rice. They just walked in there, you know what I mean, with cutters. Three elderly people cut the chains and walked in and really just sat there and waited for security. This is how lax it is. It's
unconscionable. That was a nuclear bomb plant, but
yes,
yeah.
But that's what I'm saying.
Shut down nuclear bomb plant, but still, yeah.
I mean, that's even worse. I mean, that was like completely easily, you know, penetrated. But so, Chuck, we have about 15 minutes left. I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about the current work you're doing. And actually, if there's anything that any of our listeners can do to help support your work, if you'd like us to get active in some way to make what you're doing more effective.
Well, I think the most important thing probably currently that people can put effort in is what you've been talking with Donna Gilmore about, which is this nuclear waste, this new nuclear waste bill. Would you remind me of the number again?
Oh, H.R. 3053. It's called the Nuclear Waste Policy Amendment Act of 2017.
Right. And it's in the House right now. It passed out of committee. And what this bill does is it revives the whole nuclear waste storage effort, which has been ground to a halt. During the Obama administration, President Obama promised Senator Harry Reid and Nevadans that he would shut down the efforts to make Yucca Mountain the nuclear high-level nuclear waste repository for the country. There are very good technical reasons why that's wise, but it was pure politics because in Nevada it's poisonous to be in favor of Yucca Mountain because people are rightly very concerned about all that waste coming to their state. So even the Republicans, including their current Republican governor, are fighting it as hard as they can. They even have their own agency that has been working full-time fighting it now for a couple decades.
Well, I read Senator Miller said that if it gets to the Senate, it's dead on arrival if it's the way it is. I mean, there's no way they're going to fight it tooth and nail. They know. But this is the issue. Well, we cannot let it get out of the House. We have to call every one of our elected officials
right
in the House and say, and just keep calling him and call all of them that you know about. I know yesterday I spent a little bit of time with Pete DeFazio's office sort of explaining it to him, and I actually directed them to please go to SanOnofreSafety.org. While I was on the phone, I said, look, she's got all the information. She took the time to read the 75 pages that I know mm-hmm. your office probably didn't have a chance to get to. So it's disseminated
nope.
there. This is not something that we can encourage, because even our own Kurt Schrader, Representative Kurt Schrader, Democrat from Oregon, he is in Newport and he's in Salem. That's their representative. He actually co-sponsored it. He signed up on July 17th. So I called his office and said, I hope he changes his mind. And I spent some time directing them also to her site, because I think these representatives
yeah.
have been told this is a way to finally get rid of those pesky regulations so we can find a nuclear, a permanent site. I mean, the way it's being sold.
Let me do a little myth busting on this, because in the Northwest delegation, there have been some interesting discussions about why these members of Congress think it's a good idea to pass something
great
like
idea.
This. And the first is that, well, we have all these orphaned sites. What that means is you've got a nuclear power plant that's closed down, like our Trojan plant on the Columbia River north of Portland in Columbia County, has been closed since 1993. But all of the high-level radioactive waste that was generated at that plant is still there on site. That's the one thing they still have remaining there. They've torn everything else down and taken it up to a dump site at Hanford. So this waste has nowhere to go. PGE is out of the nuclear generating business, and they'd like to have their waste picked up by the U.S. government, which promised them that they would take it. But again, the dry cast storage, with as many problems as I'm sure Donna Gilmore has given you over the years, particularly dry cast storage of the lower burn nuclear fuel that you have at Trojan, because this is that fuel predates the decision by the NRC to allow people to leave their fuel in their reactors longer and make it hotter and less stable, but it's safer to keep it on site there than it is to be moving it continually, which is what this bill envisions. It envisions setting up a temporary waste site, finding a volunteer community in the United States, most likely a couple of communities in New Mexico and Texas have business interests that want to attract this waste site. And then supposedly it would be temporarily stored there until there's a permanent disposal site. Well, as I said before, Yucca Mountain is supposedly going to be that permanent site, but their state is geared up for decades of fighting the government over it. That waste, once it moves, is likely to stay there. But even if it doesn't, you've added to the risk of having this material get out by transporting it twice. Senator Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico, when he was still serving in the Senate, established the Bingaman principle, which is no interim sites that aren't connected to the permanent, to a permanent decision for disposal. So this bill claims to be that, but it's far from that. And it also, if you pick a volunteer site that's far away from Nevada, you've really increase the risk that you're going to have an accident somewhere along the line in transporting the material. And as I said, it stays hot for a really long time. It's really dangerous material that if you had a train, fall into a canyon or some other situation that is beyond the design of the canisters, to withstand, you could have a release of this really, really dangerous material into the environment.
Well,
once that genie's out of the bottle, it's very hard to get back in it.
I mean, this bill eliminates environmental analysis for transport of nuclear waste in those casks. It also eliminates environmental safety reports. And it also requires that we start paying them for interim storage facilities, even if there's none built. I mean,
right.
It's an unconscionable... It's obviously written by the nuclear industry. It's just another giveaway to the nuclear industry. And it's being sold as a way to move us towards the solution to nuclear waste. But
what it is, it's funny. It's for years during the Obama administration, you had the Senate with one nuclear waste bill and the House with another. And the Senate nuclear waste bill was, okay, we can't win on Yucca Mountain. Let's set up an interim storage site. And there was some push from Senator Feinstein in California for this, because she's reacting to pressure in the San Onofre area, not from Donna Gilmore, but from others who want to get their spent fuel away from San Onofre as quickly as possible.
Right.
And so the Senate was in favor of setting up a system for voluntary interim nuclear waste sites, and the House would say, no, we want Yucca Mountain. And so between the two bodies, they couldn't get agreement as to how to go forward. This latest bill from Shimkus, Representative Shimkus from Illinois, who was one of the has been one of the big Yucca Mountain proponents, combines both in the bill, and they're hoping that this will pass, and now they'll come to agreement that we're going to try to do both tracks at the same time. But the thing that's kind of holding it back, and the reason they probably haven't had a vote yet, is that the nuclear waste fund, a lot of people think, okay, naturally these nuclear power companies have been saving up money for the cost of storing this high level radioactive waste, right? Yes, it's in their budget. They have to set aside a certain amount of dollars every year in order to have this waste disposed. I would argue it's not enough money, but it's some money, and it's been going into a fund theoretically that would be available for, and has been available for, the Yucca Mountain work they've done thus far, but would be available for a permanent repository. The trouble is, like Social Security funds, Congress just takes that money and puts it in the general fund, and then keeps a tab as to how much is owed. So for them to actually begin the process of reopening Yucca Mountain and doing an interim waste site, they have to actually spend general fund dollars. You know, they have to, the Republican Congress, which is trying to shrink government and is constantly not allowing new programs and is cutting back on old programs, has to actually put out, I think what I've heard is about $1 billion to get this nuclear waste program going again. And to the real budget hawks in Congress who don't want to spend money on anything, this is new money, and it has to displace some other old money that would get cut. And so that kind of thing becomes very difficult in Congress to do. And $1 billion is a lot of money to displace. So that may be what's holding up that vote in the House right now, is that fact. But it's a big ally for us right now, is the fact that Congress doesn't want to spend money. And that's probably one of our best arguments right now as well, with some members of Congress who don't understand or care about the safety issues, but are fixated on the cost, the federal budget.
Well, that's a good argument that we can do to call up and stop it. I understand that Donna says she's heard that it's going to be voted on this week. So the time is now for us to call if we're going to make an effort to stop this thing and not let it get through the House. I mean, and right. that's a good point, is actually to focus on the cost, because obviously they don't care about the safety.
I think in the case of Representative Blumenauer, Representative DeFazio, and Representative I'm blanking on her name right now, the Washington County U.S. member of Congress. If she represents you, you know her name, and I don't know why I'm not thinking of it.
And you know what, Chuck? We have 15 seconds. Oh, my gosh. You've been listening to Chuck Johnson.
Contact them all and talk about the safety issue. Those people should care.
Exactly. And take action this week, you guys. We'll talk with you guys tomorrow. Take care.
All right.
There you go. Bye, Chuck. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.